University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents award-winning poet, essayist, and writer Carol Bly and her lecture, How Do We Ever Get a Short Story Out of Real Life? A native of Minnesota, Bly's latest collection of fiction, The Tomcat's Wife and Other Stories, won the 1992 Friends of American Writers Award. A Milwaukee Journal review of that book described Bly's stories as more than just exquisitely observed details of American life. If Bly doesn't look at life through rose-colored glasses, neither does she write with dark shades on. Her literary vision is 20/20, and her creations are witty, warm, sad, and real. Bly also received a Minnesota Annual Book Award for nonfiction for The Passionate Accurate Story, published in 1990. In addition to her forum presentation, Bly also served as writer-in-residence at Nebraska Wesleyan from September 9th through 11th, speaking to classes and working with students. She has taught and lectured at several colleges and universities, including the University of Iowa, the University of Minnesota, Carleton College in Minnesota, and Hamline University in Minnesota. In April 1992, Bly received an honorary Doctor of Humane Letters degree from Northland College in Wisconsin. Join us now for University Forum and Carol Bly.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for the welcome. I'm very happy to be at Nebraska Wesleyan, a liberal arts institution. No matter how many of you major in business administration, it's still a liberal arts institution. And I'm especially happy, because I'm a gadfly and an egoist, to be invited to talk about things that are my ideas, that are dear to me, that I care for, my favorite ideas. As you know, nearly everywhere we're told to talk about ideas or are paid to talk about ideas which we have very little interest in. And in our ill-advised society, you know that the best paid people are paid to talk about ideas that they don't know anything about. Those are ideas often that we get, particularly in a political time, in which obviously the speakers have no clear passion at all, and they also haven't got much clear view of the stars or a clear view of anything that's going on. So it's great to be able to talk about something that you have a clear passion about, right or wrong. So it's lovely to sound off. I'd like to sound off first. This is what I'll do this morning. I'll sound off first and about my ideas. One could be a writer and writing species. And if we are not writers, it's because we had a mean third grade teacher, or because we have a mean society, or because we have a mean spouse, or because we have hit meanness that blocked us somewhere, wherever it was. I don't know all the ways that a person can be blocked. I know about two or three of the ways that a person can be unblocked, so that that person can write a personal history. And that personal history might, if you get old and tough and have luck, become a history that others would read as well. But the big thing is that we all get to be a track record keeper or a personal history writer. So I'm sounding off about that first, and then I will also tell you an easy way to write short stories. After all, a short story is simply that form in which one person is in the room, all affected by something that's going on, all caring, all mad, glad or bad, and someone else enters the room. There are always two. At that point, the art can't be egotistical because that second voice is in there. But sometimes that second voice is right inside ourselves. And one way we make characters for a short story, in case you haven't tried this wonderful form, which doesn't take too long, is by dividing up ourselves into our various parts. If part of us is a Nazi, for example, as must have been true in Germany in the 1930s, and is true again in Germany and in the United States and elsewhere, another part is an organic farmer. Many people who practice terrible, terrible morals are crazy about nature, and they're very careful to keep 6 inches of green, 2 inches of manure, one of earth and a scattering of wood ash, and then the same over, and turn it twice until the center comes to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. They know about compost piles, and they have wonderful philosophies of it. And on the other hand, they do such terrible things at their workplaces that we can't believe the amount of evil around us. So what we do to make a character in a story is split up ourselves to make up several of these characters. It's easy to do, very easy to do, once you listen to yourself and say this one thing that your third grade teacher didn't tell you, which is you are not one person, not just Joe or Carol or Jack, but you are several people. They're all in there, and they all have a little to say, and they're all rather like outside characters. There is an old lie, then, that we are not all writers and cannot be writers. And to undo that lie, to unlearn it, is one of the joyous experiences of our lives. The person who talked about that particularly beautifully was Denise Levertov in a poem that she ended by saying, talking about the joy and the freedom of unlearning old lies, which enables you to throw the reins down on the beast that gallops and carries us joyfully through the universe. It's a wonderful thing to do. This morning, what I'd like to do is tell you two ideas for writing, because they belong to us all, not just those of us who now write, but those who next week will also write. One of them is, when you can, make a sentence and don't ask a question. In Latin, the word is sentio, sentire, and it means I feel, I'm convinced that, I'm quite sure that. That's why we have our word sentence from that. In it, you commit yourself to an idea. Now, the idea is probably wrong. Most ideas we have are wrong. A few of them that I have this morning are wrong. They're mine. And as the patient said to the doctor who said, you need surgery to save your life, the patient said, I don't either, and I have a right to my opinion. And the doctor said, right, but your opinion's not worth anything. And that may be true, but it's better to have one and later be forced to junk it than never to have one and always be washing about and maundering about with, well, I can see there's two sides to this question. Sometimes there isn't two sides to it. As we know with battered women, it does not take two to tango. It takes one to do the battering, and the battering has happened. It doesn't take two. And so therefore, sometimes there's only one side to a question. So I suggest to you, first, when you start to write in journals or write stories, is that you become a prig. That is someone who swears by his or her own idea. And hang on to it at least for a week until someone proves you wrong. And second, it is easy to write a story using all those various parts inside you if you say to yourself, there's a point to doing literature. What is the point of literature? Well, sometimes when I used to work with the Farmers Union, we would say, that's very hard to define the humanities. I got sick of hearing that. You know, you hear a thing enough times about how it's hard to define something, and you think, what if that's a lie? What if it's easy to define the humanities? So I give you a definition this morning. This is it. And if you haven't got a stronger one, let's stick with this one until you find you know it's wrong. Here it is. The humanities, specifically literature, is to be able to make a picture in your mind, a scenario of something that has happened elsewhere, or something that might happen if you take such and such an action. Second, it's to be able to be brave enough to absorb and listen to sad and angry-making data. No matter how bad the news, you don't do a denial. You say, right, that's bad news, and I will think some way I'm going to get around it. But I will not say, oh, that can't be true, or you don't mean that. I first got onto that idea when I was living in a little town in western Minnesota where I would sometimes tell people, I don't like music very well. And they would say, oh, yes, you love music. Because they know that good people love music and bad people don't. But the fact is, I don't like music very well. I only like some music, some of the time. And I love that very much. But that was that denial of bad news, that maybe there was a person who was not criminal who also had no taste in music. And third, the humanities helps you decide which battles you're going to go to, because we can't go to them all, and you forgive yourself for not going to them all. I love this idea because it means that you can be humorous and enjoy life even though there is suffering going on at the same time. And it may seem inhuman, and someone will say, how can you laugh? How can you have fun? How can you read books even when there's so much suffering out there? And you have to be able to say, I'm not going to that battle. And if they press further, then you can say, well, I am not doing anything for Bosnia this week. And it is true, I have decided not to do anything for Bosnia. I have decided not to think about it. I simply entertain the news. It's there. I know about it. It's dreadful. But I am not going to be someone who works at it. And so therefore, I have decided not to think about it, because I don't want to have a passive, large passive piece of bad news in my head that I'm not going to do anything about. And second, if you have to, you can solve this like an Orthodox Christian. And I mention this rather piously because my favorite rector that I ever had when I was in the Episcopal Church is here this morning, and so I'm showing off a little to him. And I want to recite the fact that not everybody goes to all the battles at all times. Jesus often slipped through the crowd, and those are important lines to remember in the Bible. He did not always go to the war that was, or go to the issue that was on at the time. So it's all right to keep your sense of humor, and the humanities allows it. And finally, the humanities, or literature, asks us to care for the res publica, that is, the public affairs, to give some of our time to civic life, to lessen the level of injustice and the level of dreadful greed that's around us all the time. So having given those lists, that's what we write literature about, is to make some of those things happen, or because we wish they had happened. And it's, if we remember those five reasons, it's an all right reason for taking a list of some things in our own lives and deciding to put it together as literature. The easy way to write a short story is to make lists. So I'm going to give you my list for this story, and then I'm going to tell you a story. The story I'm going to tell you is called The Tender Organizations, taken from a line of Thoreau's, in which he says there are myriads of tender organizations in nature which are squashed out very easily. No one even feels the pain of it, he might have added. The list is this. These were the things that interested me, seven of them, at the time that I was writing this story and getting started with it. The first is, I was always interested in the difference between Martha types and Mary types. That is, people who love leaders and who love to crowd around at their feet, and who make a little trill of, oh, every time they say something. Alas, there's a gender difference here. The women, for a long time, were worse at this than the men. They would make that little trill whenever a male speaker spoke, and it makes me want to vomit. But now the men have their movement, and they're doing it too. So perhaps it isn't a gender issue, it's just something that some people do. That is, to want to follow around and admire a guru. And that's one thing, that one aspect of the Mary personality that irritates me. And I want to talk about it. On the other hand, the Martha people, who are always baking bread and letting the historical moment go by and saying, well, I'm too busy, I'm out in the kitchen doing something, they are a drag too. And yet they're the other opposite, and I wanted to do a story that had both in, and that had both in where they loved each other. So I've given those parts to a man and his wife. The second thing I was interested in is the cruelty between some men and women. I wanted to get it into a story. The third thing is the beauty of winter. I'm from Minnesota, and I think it's proper weather when the snow gets there. And when it begins to melt, we call it the snow is rotting. That is, it's not supposed to melt, it's supposed to be there. And I like winter. The fourth is, I have a brother who is afraid of dogs. I've always admired that, because he isn't afraid of anything else, but he's seriously afraid of dogs. And that seems very original to me, to be afraid of dogs, because I'm fond of them. And I wanted to get fear of dogs into a story. So that's in there some. The next one is the, to me, insane love of weaponry that some men have. They adore it. They know everything about weapons. They know that Marines trained with Springfields in 1942, whereas the Army people were getting the Garand M1. They know all that stuff, kind of memorize it and talk about it. I wanted to get that in. I think that's hysterical, the way men are that way. People have even estimated the size of the slingshot pocket that David used with Goliath. You know, that's to me is a miracle. The sixth thing is that when I was once doing a series of talks in Milwaukee, an oncology nurse came up to me and told me a terrible story, how after years and years of battering, when a man gets cancer after he's battered his wife, she sometimes will refuse to give him his meds, which would lessen the pain. And I said, is that common? And she said, no, but it happens a lot. And I thought, now that's serious wrath, serious injustice on his part for years, but a serious and, to me, really execrable response on her part. But a serious situation that I can't judge, but I wanted to get it into a story because it moved me. And finally, is church parish life, which I've had a lot of, first as a Lutheran, and later my life dream was to be an Episcopalian, which I was for some years, and liked a lot. I like the junk of Anglican parish life. I like all the little things about it, the details of it, like the way Lutherans' pastors are always being given plates by their parishioners that say things like Schönes Deutschland on them if they're Missouri Synod, or they say Willkommen til Norge if they're Norwegians. But Anglican priests get given the same sort of stuff, only it's from England. And I wanted to get that into stories. And I like all the little details, like who's going to run up the flag on the Feast of St. Andrew, November 30th, the beginning of Advent for those of you who don't do this. Sometimes that's a bloodletting issue in a church. If someone's always done it and some new person says, I'll do the flag, then there's big trouble and the priest has to solve it some way. Or his wife has to take around some cookies or something has to be done. You know, the trouble. And I like all that because underneath all of that sort of tinsel of Christian church life, even so, that affectionate junk of parish doings is a thousand times deeper a sound than the light rattle of cynicism of people who don't care for ideas at all, however corrupt the ideas may become. So those are my ideas, the list that I had for this story, and now I'd like to tell you the story called The Tender Organizations. There's a natural, satisfying enmity between the practical and the ecstatic people on the earth, as we know if we are either one or the other. There's the Martha types who love to hang around the feet of gurus, and they're the Mary types that like to hang around the feet of gurus and smile and pour oil and praise and who like a numinous life. And there are the Martha types who sneak out to the kitchen all the time, trying to get out to where the practical things are going on. Now, everyone knows that the Mary types, who are very moved by ideas, are very bored by the Martha types, who don't ever seem to have any ideas. And in fact, if you're telling them one of your favorite ideas, the Martha types, they tend to go to sleep in the middle of it. And that's annoying for the Mary people. We know that the Mary people are bored with them, but they're not half as bored as the Martha people are with the Mary types. No sooner do they hear that, oh, how much love there is in the universe, than the Martha types fall asleep right where they are, right in the middle of the Lady Chapel or any other parish church in Clayton, Minnesota, where this was, or even in the fellowship hall of a Methodist church. They simply fall asleep right in front of your eyes because they hate ideas. They like things that you can count on that stay put. Sally Thekkers was a woman of 28 years old, very healthy, rather comely rather than pretty, a history major she'd been in college, who was married to an Anglican priest named Jack Thekkers. She tended to wear a hole-of-field jacket around in the wintertime, around the house and outside all the time. And now at the point that this starts, she was 6 weeks pregnant with their first child. So they were living in a kind of a limbo, the way you do when you're expecting your first child. She had colorless hair, rather weak, and wasn't really much looking, but that was good for her because it enabled her to sneak out to the kitchen whenever any one of Jack's parishioners who was having an ecstatic Christian experience would come and want to sit by the hearth and talk to him about it. She would start easing out just like that undertaker in Mark Twain would slide along the side of the room as smooth as a cat. She would get out into the kitchen and disappear if she possibly could. She was a person who in the summertime liked to grow perennials in her garden. She liked Carpathian harebells, which are rather scant and a poorish flower to grow, but rather elegant with all their green underneath. It was the last week before the Feast of St. Andrew, getting cold, and Sally and Jack had the problem that Episcopal priests and their wives always have, which is how to get some time alone so that they can just hang out together in front of their fireplace on a cold day and get a fire going and sit there. They were always trying to get alone. His $24,000 a year package plus different benefits like the house and so forth that he got made him a professional. So he couldn't do what he had to act like a professional, just as if he were rich like somebody at Merrill Lynch or a very rich surgeon. But the fact was he wasn't rich, and it was hard to get alone. But he was too professional to do things like what we do in the women's movement now, which is to suddenly simply say we were not going to do our work today because I have to do something for myself. That expression, I have to do something for myself, is now very big with women. And it's important. But on the other hand, Jack never got to say it, nor did Sally, because they were clergy people. And so therefore, it was hard for them to be alone. And Sally had sneaked out into the kitchen in order to avoid the remarks of a born-again Christian who was talking to Jack in the hearth, beside the hearth. In the kitchen, she could hear the hushed sleep ticking on the windows, and she was singing a violent nursery rhyme to the baby inside her in order to tell it the nature of life. The one she was singing is, three mice went into a cellar to spin. Puss passed by. And Puss looked in. What are you doing, my little man? We are sewing clothes for gentlemen. Well, let me help you bite off your threads. Oh, no, dear Pussy, you'd bite off our heads. Chin chopper, chin chopper, chin chopper, chin. Here's a candle to light you to bed. And here's a chopper to chop off your head. She was telling that to the baby. She was also pretending that she was not yet that she was not pregnant. She was partly pretending that she was still a freestanding human being who had no responsibilities of the kind of people who have a baby inside them. She was pretending that it no longer mattered about her husband's slight faults, which now worried her. His slight faults, by the way, were that he believed in a God who answered personal prayers, and also, which she did not, despite the fact that 7 million people died in the German camps. And he was afraid of dogs. Now, she was afraid of dogs, too, but he was twice as afraid of dogs. And she noticed that, and now it bothered her. It had seemed charming to her that he was that afraid of dogs, but now it seemed a little frightening because she thought he needs to be strong because we have to protect the baby. She was a very protective person. She and Jack were in the twilight of their first happiness together. Their first happiness as lovers was now over, and their second happiness and their sorrow as parents of a child were now beginning. Today, on Tuesday, Jack had built a fire with wood that Carolyn, friend of theirs who ran a veterinary shop, and George, Carolyn's husband who ran the Super Value store, and Mercine, the oncology nurse, and some other friends, and Jack and Sally had cut off a woodlot 2 years before. He'd built the fire of this wood, and it was 10:30 in the morning, and they had hoped to be alone to drink tea in front of the fire. But Dick had come, Mercine's brother, 42, old enough not to be a born-again Christian, Sally thought. Nonetheless, he was. And Dick wanted to stay where he was, in Clayton, a nice town with calm, low-paying jobs, where life is good and you can hunt half of nearly every day in the fall. You can go up around Emily and Roosevelt Lake and Lawrence Lake and stand in a deer stand all day and do a little drinking without getting into trouble with anyone, and come back and have an easy life. But his wife wanted to go to the Twin Cities. Well, they were enthusiastic Christians, and so therefore they had decided to lay out the fleece. And that is, Dick had said to God, If you give me a sign today while I'm hunting, I will go to the Twin Cities with my wife. But if you don't give me a sign, we get to stay here. So he was telling that to Jack, and Sally was very, she had disappeared out to the kitchen. She'd gone off and taken a beat-up piece of fair linen, which she'd ironed, and brought them in a tray with tea and food to eat, and then was trying to disappear and not hear this story. Dick had gone up near Emily and then had got into a blind by Lawrence Lake and had hunted all day and had seen nothing to kill and had had no sign from Jack, from God. And so now he had come back rejoicing because he didn't have to move and it was all right with God. And his wife agreed it was all right with God too. And therefore, he was going to stay. And out of gratitude to Jack, their wonderful rector whom they loved, they had brought a Williams Sonoma bowl to give them as a present. Now, Sally, listening in the kitchen, thought, you know, why won't a born-again Christian just give you a Williams-Sonoma bowl and say, look, here's a bowl? Instead, you have to listen to their rhetoric. You know, the rhetoric is like your fellow servants of God. You know what I mean? I mean, you're kind of like you're with God, with me. And you have to listen to all of that before they'll say, and here's the bowl. Well, after Dick left, Sally, who had morning sickness, threw up. Jack washed the dishes, and Sally lay down in an old maid's room, back when Anglicans, Episcopalians in the state of Minnesota had a little money and there was a maid's room. There was this shadowy and poorish room with a sort of hard cot just off the kitchen for the maid, a kind of a cold and dark place where she could still hear the sleet, which was a nice sound. And she lay there feeling weak in the kitchen back hallway, and peaceful, too. There were no more putting of maids in drafty rooms like that. That was one evil that was done away with, thank goodness, across from the firewood chute. Jack came to sit down. He sat in the half-dark with her on the edge of the cot, and he said, how's the baby? Happily, to her. And she imagined the baby. She told him she was singing it a tune, and she was also singing it the Magnificat, using the tonus peregrinus, which is the most difficult of the tones to sing in. And but also trying not to swear as much. I'm trying to keep my language clean so it doesn't hear that kind of thing, she said. She imagined the baby in the vaulty, blood-colored womb inside her, hanging on for dear life inside there, the seed and the egg, so newly united that they were still excited at finding each other and were binding with each other fast as night, and the baby was forming into a human being. The baby must feel a little rangy inside that huge womb with all that space, the way she and Jack actually felt a little rangy in their rectory. It was a typical Episcopal rectory. It was a fake, half-timbered Tudor building, not built on the Tudor system, but built on regular American system, but then you slap up some boards and stain them black and put plaster in between so it looks Tudor. It was like that. It was a handsome place. It had ivy growing up it, which was now furred up with the sleet. It was in the catchment area of the police of the town of St. Cloud, Minnesota, and in the catchment area for hospice work of Mercine, their friend, the oncology nurse, and in the catchment area of psychological intake of the Mora Mental Health outlet there run by the state, and in the catchment area of Anglophiles. It was in the catchment area of the Episcopal Church. Sally and Jack got lots of Anglophiliac gifts all the time for the parish, like those plates that say Willkommen til Norge that Lutherans get, which when you turn them over, they say Made in Bergen or they say Made in Kyoto, about half and half of each. They got things. Theirs were, the one that they had now, was a tall tea tray that they hung on the wall that originally had been a list of rules for servants' halls in England in the 19th or 18th centuries, in which it said that if any servant comes to the table at this hall and eats and doesn't wear a jacket, that'll be threepence halfpenny fine that he must pay, and it was tuppence fine for feeding a dog underneath the table. And Sally curled her lip at these things. Jack said, no, Sally, they're not evil. They're just silly. These are places, presents from a loved place, namely England, and therefore they feel holy to the people who give them, and so therefore we don't sneer at them. So now Jack said, how is the baby? And Sally thought about it and told him how she was cussing less and trying to give the baby good tone and telling it history whenever she could think of it. Even back there in that little maid's room, they could hear the sleet, its wet and tinny sound outside the house. Next day was Wednesday, which was choir practice day, and Jack counted on their being alone, because the way parish people figure is Wednesday night, Jack will at some time show up during choir practice, so therefore they can catch hold of the rector then, and they'll leave him alone during the day. So they had planned to drink a lot of tea by the fire on Wednesday and stay there in that cold and increasingly cold weather. But Mercine called, the oncology nurse, a friend of theirs, and she told them about the Schlager situation. Now, Otto Schlager was a German-American, an old man now, who lived in their town, who had beaten his wife for years and years. And now, Vi Schlager was not giving him his every four-hour meds, and it was an impossible situation. He was suffering tremendously. When Mercine would come to the house, he would be in agony, and she would have to give him a shot. Now, a shot is not good treatment for the pain of cancer, but meds are. Orally taken suppositories if necessary, but the shot only catches you up and it doesn't stay on top of it. And so she explained all that to Jack, and she said, listen, I can't do anything with Kurt, the Missouri Synod pastor. Can you do something with him? You belong to the ministerium. Talk to him and get him to talk to Vi Schlager so that she'll let her husband have these meds. Well, so Jack said, all right, I'll ask him over, and he did ask him over. He went to Sally, and he said, Kurt is going to come over. Kurt came. Sally baked some white muffins for him, and Kurt came, and all the time that Sally was serving them in the room where she'd hoped to sit with Jack, Kurt waited and made small talk about hunting with her husband, waiting till she should get out of the room. He kept saying things like, oh, the Schlagers, right. They have that beautiful Airedale. It's true, something wrong with its eye, but I sure would like to have an Airedale like that. Now, I wouldn't just work that dog either. I think a dog ought to have fun. In fact, I think hunting should be fun for everybody. And so I'd really like to have that wonderful Airedale bitch that they had. And Jack and Sally could hear Jack explaining, listen, Kurt, there's great pain here. This is trouble. This is a bad marriage, and now it's going worse. We have to do something. And Sally heard Kurt say, oh, yeah, Vi Schlager. Yeah, she came to me a couple of times. She was complaining about a mouse he'd given her. Got a black eye, two of them, matter of fact. And I thought, well, I know, you know, that's something all right, but I think that a woman can do, she could wear a little lipstick or something. There's no reason that she has to look the way she looks. I know she's a wonderful housewife, but couldn't she make up a little bit? And I thought, anyway, it takes two to tango. If there's something wrong, I'd talk to both of them. So Jack said, so did you talk to both of them, Kurt? And he said, well, no, he never came in, so I figured they worked out something between them. They had that kid, too, that went off to the Twin Cities someplace. And Jack said, yes, ran away. But you don't know anything about that. And Kurt said, no, the kid came too. But I didn't make too much of it, tell you the truth. Then, while Sally was out in the kitchen, she heard two thuds on the floor. So she put her head round the kitchen door to see what was going on in there. And there was Kurt on his knees in the fireplace, near the fireplace, and Jack near him, unwillingly down on his knees too. And they were praying. Kurt was saying, Almighty God, please help Vi Schlager to find her appropriate love in her heart and help her to do what she ought to do and not to do the things she ought to do and so forth. And Sally disappeared again into the kitchen. She got on her holy filled vest. And Jack said, where are you going? And she said, you need to not know. She got on her holy filled vest and she went out and he said, drive carefully, the sleet's freezing up. She said, all right, thank you. She went out down to 8th Avenue where George's Super Value was. She asked his produce man, where's George? Oh, he's out back in the office. To get out to the back of the office of a Super Value store, you go out through the warehouse part where the cold vegetables are that are lying limp far from wherever they were born, lying there in half-opened crates and very cold. She got into the little office. It was warmed by an electric strip that ran around the inside. And there sat George with all his bad credits, his bounced checks, his truck invoices, and all the other makings of a super value store. She told him the story and how something needed to be done so that Beischlager would give the medicine. And she told him the idea that she had for it. And what did he think? Good idea, he said. Glad somebody's going to do something. I will call Mercine. We'll get her over here, and we'll get it going. And so he did. And the three of them stood around in that hot little room and planned very carefully what the action would be that they were going to take care of, what they were going to do exactly. Mercine took a look at Sally Thackers and said, how are you, Sally Thackers? And Sally thought, she knows I'm pregnant, just like a nurse. And Sally said, I'm fine. And Mercine said, you shouldn't be kicking around in weather like this. And Sally said, let's do this thing. Let's not stall. And Mercine said, all right, she said, but I've tried to go over to that house and tell her that her husband needs round-the-clock nursing, and she won't give it to him. She threw me out. And Sally said, she won't this time because I'm going with you. I'll go too, George said. And then he said, does Jack know about this? And she said, no, you're not going, George, and Jack's not going. You're the heavy metal. We'll save you for later. So the two women stalled around outside. It was turning into snow now, and they were having a little quarrel because they were both afraid. And finally, Mercine said, you know, we're quarreling because we're afraid to go in there. Let's go into Vi's house, and let's get this over with. And so they did. And Sally thought, this is very untowards for this baby inside me. I don't think activism is good for in utero people. I think it's bad. Yet, she thought, how could this get through to the baby after all? Because it's so far in there, self-centeredly, growing its mind and its nerves and its tiny machinery for feeling things. It must be safe inside there. At the storm door of Vi and Otto Schlager's house, they found the house was dark inside. And at the storm door, Mercine said, you do exactly everything I tell you to do, and don't do anything else. You make your speech when you want to, but I'll do everything else. Okay, Sally said. She knocked at the door, and she got her foot ready. Vi came to the door, a terrifying-looking woman, handsome German-American woman with a broad brow and very straight-across eyebrows. Normally handsome, but there was something in her face that made you glaze over with terror. She came to the door, and she looked at Mercine and Sally, and she said, I thought I told you not to come here no more. Mercine put her foot in the door, skillfully the way social workers know how to do, so that if they slam the door on it, it just gets the fat part and doesn't break your ankle. She got her foot right in there. I think traveling salespeople also know how to do that, just exactly right. And she said, we're coming in. He needs round-the-clock nursing. He don't need no round-the-clock nursing, Vi said. And she said, oh, yes, she does. Oh, yes, he does. We're coming in. And Sally said, if you don't let her in, I'm going to call the police. And it's not going to be that schlunk in your church either. It's going to be real police from St. Cloud. And so she opened the door, and she let them in. When they got in there, it was dark inside. The plants were unwatered and hanging over their clay pot edges. And on the sofa was old Otto Schlager, was bending his knees and writhing in agony. Instantly, the oncology nurse, Mercine, went over to him, and she said, in 2 minutes, better, 2 minutes, Otto. Now, in 1 minute, she had her hypo out and given a shot. She said, in just a few seconds, it'll be better. And she was talking him into peace with the drug, with the morphine that she was giving him. And Sally was watching her very carefully, thinking, why do I watch this nurse so carefully? Why should I be such a hobbyist? Why would I care to learn nursing procedure? Why don't I just live my own life? But I like technical things. How to bake oat bran muffins. How to be a nurse. How to do things. And yet it's such a distraction from what must be the real life. She was thinking that to herself at the same time that she was looking at the German woman who looked back at her just as still as a column. And now Otto was peaceful and looked not anymore like an agonizing cause that needed to have something done about it, but just like an ugly human being who'd been ugly all his life to nearly everybody. Now Vi said, okay, you, the one that's not even a nurse, you, pointing at Sally, you get out. You get out or I'll set Hoffer on you. And Sally woke up, Hoffer. Then she noticed underneath the slabs hanging down of the dining room table was a gigantic Airedale. It was lying there with its paws out in front of it and its head arched up, looking over its paws about 2 or 3 inches. Something wrong with one of its eyes, but otherwise looking straight at her. But it didn't move when its owner said its name. And she looked at it and she thought, boy, she said, I really am scared of dogs. It's true that Jack is twice as scared of them as I am, but I am scared of them. And she thought, that's bad news. And she said to the baby, this is bad news for you as well as for me. This isn't just for me. So she said, all right, she said, I'm leaving. But if you give Mercene any trouble when she stays here and moves in with you and gives the medicine every 4 hours, if you give her any trouble, I'm going to call the social worker from Mora. And do you know what that social worker's going to do? She's not going to go to your address at 312 8th Avenue. I'm going to tell her that you live at 322 8th Avenue, and she'll go there first to knock, and she'll explain who she is and why she's looking for you. And then she'll go to all the other houses until she finds yours. Vi was so angry that her cheeks shook, and she said, now get out. And so Sally got out. Mercene followed her outside. The sleet had turned to snow, and they stood there together for a while, looking at its tendrils and gang, lying along all the boughs of the basswood trees. Very beautiful, in ganglia, like something in all the biochemical world that we live in, and yet it was just snow. It was a lovely time. And Mercene said, listen, Sally Thackers, here's what you do. Don't think about Vi anymore. She's had a terrible life and a terrible marriage, but in 2 weeks he'll be dead. And then her troubles are over. And I will find her daughter in the Twin Cities, and I'll bring her here. I'll find out where she is. And this old man is not going to feel any more pain until he dies. So you go home, and that's the end of it for you. And Sally was relieved. Then 10 days went by. At Georgia Supervalue Store, the carryout boys wrote up in grease on the walls, remember how you were asking for moisture last summer? Well, here it is. Stop complaining. And other jokes. And people wrote pictures and drew pictures of themselves on the walls. And Sally told the baby, this is your first snow, because otherwise it wouldn't know, since it was so deep in the eaves of her womb inside there. She said, this is your first snow. And this snow is doing what snow does, which is to make the world not look like all its bad news, but to make the world look again like the 19th century, when everything's okay. And it makes you think, snow does, that the hole in the ozone will cure over, it'll be all right, and that there will not be any bad wars, and the navies will not be sent to bomb countries they shouldn't be sent to bomb. She told it that certainly the Antarctica will be all right, too, and all the babies in all the deep eaves of all the wombs of everybody will be safe forever. That's what the snow tells you. And technology is nothing. When she got home, Jack told her, Kurt has called. It's very interesting. Kurt has called about, and I wanted to tell you something. He leaned in the kitchen, and he said, Otto has been taken care of by Kurt, and it's very interesting that Kurt's prayers and my prayers did something, and his hands were flaring and excited as he told her there was an answer to our prayers that Vi would let Mercene move in. And Sally lied to her husband for the second time in her life. She smiled at him, as though she believed that those prayers had made the answer. The first time she'd lied at him had been once some winters before, when on a winter's night she had helped all day the guild of the church clean out the church, and she was exhausted, took a bath and brought a clipboard into their bed and went to bed before Jack and was planning 590 brick patterns for their walks and all perennials along in the garden happily. Jack came to bed and his lovemaking never distracted her from the planning. She kept thinking about it. But afterwards, she lied to him and said it was wonderful. And now she told him the second lie, that it was wonderful, about the prayers answering. And then Jack said, but I have to say, Kurt's an awfully funny fellow. He wants to talk to you about the imminent God who will answer all our prayers, but in a second, he's gotten completely distracted, and he's telling you about SAM 7s and how effective they are, or would be, against helicopters. In the middle of Advent, then, Otto Schlegel died, and 500 adults out of the 2,422 people in that town went to the funeral. Kurt gave the sermon in the Missouri Synod Church with his boyish, meaty face, gave a quite good sermon in which he connected the past of Germany and the past of America through the Schlegel family. He said that this man, whose life we celebrate here today, had a father who left Germany so he wouldn't have to serve in the Kaiser's army, and for that reason came to America, and therefore did not wear gray-green and did not fight against our boys at Chateau Thierry in the First World War, and therefore this son was able to serve as a rating on the USS Mississippi during World War II. He connected everything, but then he got distracted and he started talking about exosets. And he started talking about, exosets and how lucky Mrs. Thatcher was that the Falkland Islands, the exosets didn't work, or the whole British Navy would have been sunk, that whole team. After he had swung into ordnance, Sally went into a dream and went out to the graveyard also in a kind of a dream not thinking about what Kurt was saying at all in the sermon. She went out in a dream thinking of history and how important it was to tell everybody. After the man was buried and the flag came down, George's produce man at Super Value took the flag down and fisted it into its triangles and took the flag over to the widow and said, on behalf of the President of the United States, here is the flag. Now, Bai Schlager didn't know what expression to put on her face when she got that flag. So she did what people do. She put on the expression people sometimes put on when they've come up to the chancel to take communion, and then they must face the nave again with the people in it. She put that expression on her face as she received the flag. Then Jack took Sally's arm and said, "Tomorrow we have no deaths, no births, no one is sick. No one needs us for anything. We'll have a day by ourselves. It's going to work. It'll be wonderful." He took her arm as though they were leaving a dance. "That will be our day." Sally was over her morning sickness, so she said, "Okay, I'll bake oat bran muffins." And he said, "All right." Then he said, "No, oat bran muffins are a drag." And she said, "You're right, they are. Oat bran is a drag." But the next day at 10 o'clock, the doorbell rang, and a large woman with strong, springing, yellowish hair, about 35 years old, came in. And she said, "Are you Mrs. John Thackers?" And Sally at the door said, "Yes." And the woman pushed past her, and Sally said to the baby, "That was close." And she said, "But nonetheless, she's getting out of here in 15 minutes because we're going to have the day to ourselves." This woman said, "Well, I'm looking for you. My name is Francine Schlager." Jack came into the room and said, "Oh, you're Otto and Bai Schlager's daughter. We didn't know you'd come for the funeral." "I'd never come for the funeral," she said. "I just came up today to close the house and pick up Mother and take her down to the Twin Cities for a couple of weeks and put the dog down and take the food out of the refrigerator." "But," she said, "on my way up here today, I had a direct experience with God, and I want to describe it to you." So Sally started easing on out of it to get out to the kitchen where she wouldn't have to hear. But Francine was tough. And Francine said, "You just come right back here and listen to this." So Sally did, you know, following orders and being willing to listen to somebody if they force her to. Francine said, "There I was on 52 coming up. And I heard this voice say, watch for beautiful animals on the right." And I said to the voice, "Listen, I don't believe in stuff like that. That's for Joan of Arc, and she's a Catholic. I'm a Lutheran, so that's out." But the voice again said, "Watch for beautiful animals on the right." Well, then she passed a crow who was eating on a large carcass, about the size of a dog. And the carcass was so fresh that the blood and tendrils of its intestines, which the crow was picking apart, were still flexible and bright, bright red. And she said to the voice, "If that's your idea of beautiful animals, it's not beautiful enough." And then the voice said, "Watch for beautiful animals on the right." Just then her car raced over a bridge on the Rum River, and she looked out on the ice in the early morning light, and there was a male deer with 6 or 7 does standing with their skinny black legs against the white of the ice. The deer were upset by the sound of the car racing over the bridge, and so they pawed their legs a little. And the male turned and showed her his full rack, and all the does bowed. So she said, "All right, that's it, isn't it? That's a vision, isn't it?" And Jack was talking to her quietly when Sally went out to the kitchen, saying, "Something to hang on to for a lifetime, something beautiful, something to hang on to for a lifetime," and was easing her on out and to the door and out to her car to leave. When he came back into the room, Sally had her Holofield jacket on, and he said, "Where are you going?" And she said, "You need not to know." And he said, well, drive carefully, because the snow is really turning to ice now. It's very dangerous. She did drive very carefully. She drove past the hospital with the maternity wing, where part of her soul had already moved in, because she was planning to have a baby, the same way that part of her soul moved in to the rectory when she was engaged to Jack first and knew that she was going to be there. She moved past there, got north, and got to Carolyn's Veterinary Hospital. When she got in, Carolyn was working with a little cat, holding it with one hand and reaching for medicine behind her with the other hand. And she said, hi. Sally said, hi. Francine Schlager's been trying to call you all morning, but the line was busy. It isn't busy, Carolyn said. I've been right here, working with this fellow. And Sally said, well, she must have called the wrong number, Sally said in a silky voice. Anyway, she then called me and told me to tell you that she'd changed her mind about that dog. She told me to put that Airedale down, Carolyn said. She said it was ferocious. Sally said, yeah, she's changed her mind. I'm supposed to take the dog for a couple of weeks, and you're supposed to give me 50 pounds of feed and a leash. Most important, the leash, she mentioned. And I'll take it, and then in 2 weeks she's going to pick it up. Oh, is that right, Carolyn said. And the two women looked at each other, a straight look. And she said, all right, but take care with this one. She said, this one's been beaten, Sally. It's been ill-treated. But if you give it lots of water and lots of food and are quiet around it, she may come out all right. It's an Airedale bitch, and her name is Hoffer. So she went back, and she brought out a dog that looked as though it had grown since the last time Sally saw it. She'd never seen such a large animal. She put the leash on it, and she took it out to the car, and then she had to make a decision. If she put it in the back seat, it'd scare her to death because she'd see its face every time she looked in the rearview mirror. If she put it in the front seat, it'd be right next to her and it could kill her before she could even break the car down. So she thought, what would be most respectful? Because when you're really, truly cowardly, then you treat the enemy with great respect. And she said, I think I'll put it in the front seat next to me, just as though it were as good as a person. She opened up the front seat door, and Hoffer leapt up in perfectly equably. Then she went home. Jack met her at the door, and he took her Hollowfield jacket. He hung it on the visitor's coat rack near the door, and he said, come by the fire. I've made tea. Then he saw the dog, and he manfully took its leash, and he said, hello, big fellow, somewhat in his falsetto. Sally said, big girl. She's a girl. Hello, big girl, Jack said. And then he took the bag of feed. He went out to the kitchen, and he filled up a Williams Sonoma bowl with the feed. Then he went and got another bowl and filled it with water, and he set both bowls between their two chairs by the fire. And the fire was reflected a little bit in the water of the one bowl, and the two of them sat down to wait for everything to be ready that he fixed in the kitchen, with their hands dangling over the edges of their chairs. Alone, finally. Jack said, you see what a good husband I am? Do you hear me asking questions? As soon as I get out of the cold sweat that animal puts me in, I'm going to bring out some muffins and all the things, but just for now, you don't hear me questioning you or complaining at all. And she said, that's right, very good man, very good man. And she told the baby, very good man. Then they heard a bony sound, and they looked around behind them. Hoffer had lain down bonily on the bare floor. She was thinking things over as well as she could. She knew what her plan was. She knew that she was going to creep forward, and she was going to eat some of the food out of the bowl, if that's what that was. Then she was going to drink some of the water out of that other bowl, if that was that was. Then she was going to kiss the hands of both these human beings, although she'd only seen the female of them once and the male not at all. She meant to do that. She was going to kiss them thoroughly. Because when Hoffer was a puppy a long time ago, and lay in a litter of other puppies, her mother had said, now listen, you puppies, if you don't adore human beings, even if they beat you, if they give you blows, or if they kiss you, if you don't adore them in either case, you know what'll happen to you? No, the puppies didn't know. And she said, you'll get the great emptiness. That's what'll happen to you. Now, the puppies didn't know what the great emptiness was, but they knew it was execrable, whatever it was. And so Hoffer had obeyed her mother and had loved the Schlager family all the days of her life. She'd been beaten by the male and sometimes by the female, and once, even when it came to the child of her people, she had had to make the only moral decision of her life. which was the male went after the child of the people, and she could have the rage of the smell, the same smell of the same blood on both sides, and she had to decide whose side to take. And so she decided to save the child of the people, the girl. And in return for that, the male went after her with a board with a nail in it, and she lost her eye. It was a sorry business all told. The child grew up and went away. They gradually stopped beating her, but it was a bad scene. But now, these people, she thought. Well, she decided that she would crawl forward. Her jaw was already wet with the idea, and she was going to lick them both up thoroughly between all their fingers and up to the cuffs of their sweaters. And then she was going to do that and try to explain something with her tongue. She knew she wouldn't be able to get it across, because you can never explain anything to people. But she was going to try to explain with her tongue what great danger she'd been in, how near death she'd been. And she was also going to explain that even though they scarcely show, life is filled with both danger and ecstasy, and it's right under the surface. Thank you.
Today's guest on University Forum has been award-winning poet, essayist, and writer Carol Bly. Her lecture was entitled, How Do We Ever Get a Short Story Out of Real Life? This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent, coeducational, undergraduate liberal arts institution, nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.